This is Dr. Patty Shelton, and you are listening to the LongevIQ podcast. We discuss anti-aging and longevity science and how to benefit from it so we can all live long, healthy, happy lives. Just before we get started, a quick medical disclaimer. This podcast is for informational purposes only. It is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease or to provide or replace medical advice. Please use this information to educate yourself as much as possible and share this information with a qualified health practitioner that you trust. In this episode, we'll talk about a major hallmark of aging and one of the most exciting and cutting-edge areas in today's longevity and anti-aging science called cellular senescence. Senescent cells are damaged aging cells that stop multiplying but don't die when they should. Almost like zombies, they stick around, causing a lot of trouble to nearby healthy cells and accumulate in aging tissues all over the body. Removing senescent cells has been shown to be a promising and powerful anti-aging strategy that can help with many age-related issues. But do we know enough yet to benefit from these exciting discoveries? Is there something that we can do today to help our body get rid of senescent cells? And if so, what is the best way? Are there any risks? Our guest today is Dr. Anil Bajnath, MD, an anti-aging precision medicine physician and an expert in cellular senescence and senescent cells. We'll dive into the science of senescent cells and how they affect the aging process. We'll then look into practical things we can all do to help our body naturally reduce senescent cells with supplements and lifestyle tips. Also joining us today, as always, is Amir Ginsberg, the founder of LongevIQ. Welcome, Dr. Bajnath. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a true pleasure. Thank you.
And we know you are a true anti-aging expert. You live and breathe this topic every day. So we would love to talk to you a little bit about senolytics. And maybe you could start with just for anyone who isn't really aware about what senescent cells are, what senolytics are, just a very kind of high-level overview of what we're talking about.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, you know, I think cellular senescence is a really fun topic when it comes down to aging, health, and disease formation. It's really interesting because the conversation kind of stems and originates back in, I think, 1961 in Dr. Hayflick's lab, where he was studying fibroblast cells in culture and had identified these fibroblast cells reaching its end mitotic potential, meaning each cell had its ability to undergo X amount of cellular divisions before it reached its endpoint of its ability to divide. That later became known as the Hayflick limit. And what also was heard around that time is that these cells that reach the Hayflick limit don't necessarily die or remove from circulation, and they're not necessarily alive either. And it's interesting how these cells reach this phase of cellular senescence, or also known as the literature of zombie cells. There are multiple different mechanisms that contribute to the development of cellular senescence. And a lot of that could be due to injury. So various mechanisms of cellular injury. And we know that there's several different forms of genotoxicity and cellular toxicity, cytotoxicity, that could potentially occur due to different environmental signals and inputs, leading to a whole host of accumulation of damage within a single cell. That damage could be on a membrane level, and it could be associated with membrane lipid peroxidation due to trans fatty acids and different fried foods and things of that nature that could literally release smoke into the cell membrane and lead to the cell membrane damage, which ultimately could lead to a loss of cellular regulation and a loss of integrity of its internal compositional structure. And also different damage could lead to protein misfolding and DNA damage, and different forms of reactive oxygen species could actually be toxic to your DNA. This is known as genotoxicity. And then there's also mitochondrial damage with uncoupling, which could lead to, you know, a loss of regulation and increased permeability that can mediate a whole host of different kind of dysfunctional processes downstream. Now, it's this accumulated damage that could lead to the potential of the development of cellular senescence. When these cells reach this kind of burden, so to speak, where it loses its ability to auto-regulate and repair, it has the potential of transitioning into this unique state. Now, before it gets there, typically some cells have a few different mechanisms to correct that damage and remove itself from circulation to prevent its persistence in existence, so to speak. And those mechanisms that are built in inherently include what's known as programmed cell death, also known as apoptosis. Okay, so apoptosis is one of these inherent programming features that if a cell reaches a point where it needs to be disassembled, it's that auto destroy button that's there. So they'll allow it to have a controlled removal from affecting any other cells. So apoptosis is one of those mechanisms that cells are removed from circulation. Another very important mechanism for which cells are removed from circulation is autophagy. Autophagy, as you may know, is the body's internal process of cellular recycling and self-eating. And this is usually triggered by various mechanisms, including intermittent fasting and different factors such as AMP kinase signaling and mTOR inhibition. And then another main mechanism for which these zombie cells are removed from circulation is through cellular necrosis. Now, it's important to differentiate between apoptosis and necrosis because both of those are very important features. However, the necrosis is actually kind of elicits this highly uncontrolled inflammatory response. So that's something that should be taken into consideration. But what happens if a cell is not able to be removed from circulation? It ends up getting locked into the state of cellular senescence where it's no longer actively dividing, all right? And it's not necessarily destroyed either. And it's important to differentiate that because there are different cells that get locked into cellular arrest, okay? And cellular arrest could occur in different phases of the cell cycle. There's, you know, this G1 phase, S phase, G2 phase, and M phase of normal cell cycle regulation. What differentiates senescent cells from like quiescent cells, for example, is that it's arrested in what's known as a G1 phase or inner phase, for which cells are still actively undergoing internal synthesis and is considered metabolically active. Again, there are other forms of these cells, like I said, the quiescent cells versus senescent cells, which is very important to take into consideration. Ultimately, when these cells are arrested in this development, it has the ability to continue to spew out these really noxious substances known as proteins or senescent-associated secretory phenotype, these different proteins that influence and poison the well around them. And it's been said that just one senescent cell out of 7,000 to 15,000 or so could initiate the entire degenerative process. We know that there's multiple different factors that contribute to its development. And it is actually very intricately related to the hallmarks of aging. Senescent cells is actually one of the 9 hallmarks of aging. I think we've discussed this before, but just for your audience, if they're not familiar with the hallmarks of aging, this is a paper that was published back in Cell Biology in 2013. With Dr. Lopez and his group that have characterized the main fundamental hallmarks that influence and mediate the biological aging process. It starts off with your primary hallmarks of aging, which include genomic instability, telomere attrition, epigenetic alteration, and loss of proteostasis. And then it moves into these what's known as antagonistic hallmarks, which is further characterized by deregulated nutrient signaling, mitochondrial dysfunction, and then ultimately cellular senescence cell development. Now, cellular senescence is the 7th hallmark of 9. The last 2 terminal hallmarks are also known as integrative hallmarks that are responsible for this inflammaging pathophenotype, which includes stem cell exhaustion and altered intercellular communication. So cellular senescence is downstream, but still just a little upstream in regards to the whole dynamics of the hallmarks of aging.
And is this something that's happening in all tissues throughout the body, more or less equally?
That's a great question. So there are some tissues that are considered post-mitotic, right? Like neurons and certain Leydig cells and the testicles and things of that nature are considered kind of post-mitotic tissues for which they're not actively undergoing replication. So they have a different mechanism, or similar but a different mechanism, of their ability to develop senescent cells or zombie cells. So the potential for this accumulation of damage could be anywhere. And actually, these senescent cells have been shown to accumulate systemically in the bone. It's been associated with osteopenia and fibrosis. In the lungs, there are clinical studies that influences idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, and the kidney. It's been shown to also affect fibrosis as well as heart failure. It's been implicated in various different neurodegenerative diseases. There's a couple of clinical trials going on with that as well.
How would somebody know if they have a high burden of senescent cells? Is there a way to test? Do we just go by symptoms or their age? How would somebody know?
That's a great question. Right now, I don't think there is a set consensus that this is the magic biomarker that determines our body's potential senescent cell burden, unfortunately. I think the closest thing that we have to that right now is measuring SA beta galactosidase. SA stands for senescent associated beta galactosidase. A couple of other clinical markers that are emerging. The Buck Institute out of California has done the greatest amount of research in regards to characterizing and developing what's called a SASP atlas. But the thing is, not all senescent cells are the same. There's a life cycle to this cell as well. There's something called early senescence and late senescence. And it's characterized by different phenotypic kind of characteristics that deal with its ability to have expression of various SASP proteins, right? These SASP proteins are involved with everything from the cell's ability to evade apoptosis, to modulate inflammation, to alter cellular signaling and nutrient signaling. These SASP proteins vary amongst every single senescent cell. So the consensus right now is, you know, I think there are a couple of surrogate markers that could be potentially obtained. And I think that SA beta galactosidase is seemingly one of the more promising surrogate markers. And then also P21 and P16, which are different molecules that are unique to senescent cells. However, you know, sometimes there's an upregulation of senescent cells in like wound healing. So not all senescence is necessarily bad, right? We need a balance of senescent cells in our system to a certain extent to help with natural cell turnover and things of that nature. And we do see this transient elevation in certain, like P21 example, when there's some sort of wound healing taking place. Another biomarker on the horizon is oxalipin, but that has not been validated in humans as yet. And then there is about 2 papers that I've seen on ferritin, which is also known as an acute phase reactant during an inflammatory process, being associated with a senescent cell burden. And I've seen this a lot of times with individuals that just have this burden of chronic inflammation. Their ferritin levels are high. And there's some papers that associate that as being a good surrogate marker for cellular senescence.
Do the senescent cells begin accumulating? Like around what age might they start to show up in tissues? Is that highly variable between humans?
Actually, we have senescent cells in utero. The senescent cells are really important for embryogenesis and embryonic development involved with childbirth. And as we grow, these senescent cells play a very important role in development and regeneration. So when senescent cell accumulation outpaces the immunological system's ability to remove it from circulation, and that's when it hits a tipping point and accelerates the aging process. I don't think there is a set number per se, because it's so dynamic. But from an aging standpoint, it is argued that individuals in their mid-20s potentially beginning the process of accumulation of these senescent cells and leading to its burden. And it's argued that some of these senolytic protocols out there could actually begin in age of 30s or so, you know, to be taking this into consideration for like a graceful aging kind of program.
It's a perfect transition into how do we help the body remove senescent cells? And maybe we can talk a little bit about lifestyle types of things, and then we can get into the supplements, the senolytics or senomorphics or whatever type of chemicals we might be using to do that.
Well, that's a great question. And I think it's always going to be important to stay kind of lifestyle heavy first, because these are, you know, within our locus of control of trying our best to implement and execute different lifestyle and dietary factors that ultimately will have an enhanced impact on our epigenetic expression, which is another hallmark of aging. And I really think that's our greatest opportunity for outcomes, you know, where we make conscious dietary lifestyle changes to enhance favorable gene expression. And we have that with the ability to be cognizant of the foods we're eating, right? Minimizing glyphosate and GMOs and all those other things that lead to upstream damage, right? And the genotoxicity and everything else. There's this theory called the unitary theory of aging, which deals with if you target potentially one hallmark of aging, it'll have effects on other hallmarks upstream and potentially downstream. But this is where I kind of argue that sometimes going in just to remove the cellular senescence doesn't mean you're going to have the regenerative potential. And I think that's where some of these human studies failed. There was a study that recently was performed by an organization, Unity, very specific proprietary formula looking at intra-articular injections in osteoarthritic knees, and study did not do well. And it didn't do well because you remove senescent cells doesn't mean you're going to have the regenerative potential afterwards to help with just the regeneration of that degenerated articular hyaline cartilage, right? I think targeting senescent cells, it needs to have a very specific strategy. And I think one of the more evidence-based strategies of removing senescent cells outside of these protocols per se is just looking at intermittent fasting and modulating autophagy. New England Journal of Medicine has published a wonderful publication looking at upregulating autophagy through intermittent fasting. And intermittent fasting has been shown to really help with all sorts of longevity promoting mechanisms and cancer prevention. Those are strong words from New England Journal of Medicine. Okay. So I think that's important to look at. So we know that whenever we're doing this intermittent fasting, time-restricted feeding, we have the ability to upregulate some of those recycling mechanisms through autophagy, which helps with decreasing that burden, that senescent cell burden. So I think that's one thing to look at. But again, going back to that unitary theory of aging, if we work upstream with our dietary lifestyle factor, organic eating, movement and activity, I like to explore the different biohacks. I have a hyperbaric oxygen chamber in my practice that I like to use that has been shown to help with telomere attrition. But to answer your question, I think what you're asking and what your audience would probably want to hear about is what are the different set of therapeutic options that are available commercially, right? Where's the research going and everything else? There's two different main ways to address this issue. It's either through senolytic agents, which are basically agents that create senolysis, which lyses the cell, breaks it down, and removes it. So it's going to destroy it. And then there's senomorphic, which is going to work on modulating some of these SAS proteins that we had discussed. In regards to like some of the senolytic therapies, the one that has so far the leading amount of evidence, you know, in human studies is the dasatinib and quercetin. It's been shown three published studies. One of them coming from Wake Forest and one of them coming from Mayo Clinic. Dasatinib, quercetin, and DQ for short, as we discussed this, is a viable option, safe and viable option for removing some of these senescent cells from circulation. And there's actually so many different clinical studies that are active and underway right now in phase two trials that are assessing, you know, the role of DQ and so many different types of outcomes, from hematopoietic stem cell transplant patients, Alzheimer's disease, COVID patients, cardiovascular disease. And so the list is growing, right? So the dasatinib and quercetin trials right now are growing. And that's seemingly one of the more promising interventions as a senolytic therapy. Another really exciting kind of intervention is something called fisetin. Fisetin is a flavonoid derived from strawberries, and it actually outperformed 9 other different flavonoid compounds. There's this one study, and it's a mouse study, where they compared 10 different flavonoids, and fisetin was one that outperformed everyone and demonstrated to be associated with an increase in lifespan in these mice. And fisetin, again, it's found in various forms of citrus fruits and strawberries and things of that nature. I don't even think there's an LD50, meaning they found a lethal dose of this molecule as yet. It's really exciting. There's a bunch of human clinical trials that are coming downstream with this, and it's something to look out for to be used and incorporated in a senolytic program and protocol. Again, this is still the wild, wild west. Research is growing and emerging. I'm confident here in the next, I want to say 6 to 18 months, we're going to have a better understanding as some of these clinical trials are wrapped up on how we could start leveraging these powerful reagents to remove these senescent cells from our system and tissue. That's a senolytic trials. Then we have these synamorphic agents, and this is kind of where it's like, all right, how do we modulate autophagy, right? And this, it could get into the whole rapamycin and sirolimus kind of research. Rapamycin, it's an immunosuppressive drug that's used in transplant medicine. It was originally discovered in the soil of Eastern Ireland, and it was originally adapted for and was going to be used as an antibiotic until it was found to have that really powerful immunosuppressive effects to prevent host versus graft rejection. It's used regularly in medicine to prevent that kind of process from taking place. But what is being now used for its ability to induce autophagy through its inhibition of mTOR, and as you may know, mTOR is the mammalian target of rapamycin, or the mechanistic target of rapamycin. And mTOR is like that master regulatory switch, so to speak. And when that switch is turned off, our body's ability to turn on the conservative mechanisms for self-preservation, where it starts breaking down all the kind of worn out tissues and junky cells, so to speak, through the process of autophagy, so that our body could go in there and recycle things. So rapamycin is being used now in similar effects to like a senolytic protocol to just go in there and turn on that cellular housekeeping, so to speak. So rapamycin is a really interesting molecule. Again, still lacking some of the studies needed to use for this purpose and intention and outcome. However, there is a clinical study undergoing right now. It's phase two, should be finished within 12 months, called the PEARL trial. And this is going to be assessing the safety and efficacy for rapamycin in aging. That's going to be really exciting because that could be something we could start infusing potentially. And again, in a strategy towards graceful aging. And then we've had conversations before about all sorts of different agents that have been shown to also work a little similarly, but different, and its ability to inhibit mTOR, and that's various different supplements and agents out there. So the list goes on.
You mentioned the fisetin in food. And so that kind of leads to the question, can people get enough of these things through their diet to have a clinically significant impact? Or do we need doses that are just much higher than we could ever eat the strawberries to acquire?
I really think we're going to need it in supplement form, unfortunately, because you would have to eat pounds and pounds of fruit. You'll probably, you know, have diarrhea first before you could consume and tolerate all those foods, you know, to get the appropriate amount of fisetin from the diet. But it's not to say don't eat those foods. By all means, again, eat a colorful rainbow diet. Try to get those different polyphenols and flavonoids in there. In the class that I teach at the university, I'm a professor at George Washington University, and I'm the course director for two classes. The first class is the omics of medicine, where I teach other docs that are in the fellowship in integrative medicine how to connect these molecular dots, so to speak, from genome to pathophenome. One of our greatest opportunities from a nutrigenomic perspective is harnessing these foods and these different flavonoids, because we know that food is not just medicine, but food is information communicating with our DNA, influencing our gene expression, turning up and down that volume switch and epigenetic expression. And we need to make sure that we're feeding our DNA the appropriate information.
You're mentioning several prescription drugs, dasatinib and things like this. Are these things currently available to people for an anti-aging purpose or not yet? And are there any cautions that you would urge as we're thinking about using these for that purpose?
In my practice, it's something that I do offer to patients on a very case-by-case basis. It's not something we just jump into. It should be used as a part of this kind of longitudinal age management program. And before you jump into anything of this nature, you should definitely be cleaning out the terrain. And when I say the terrain or the milieu, it's just making sure that the environment is ready to receive that message. It should be done with grace and caution because it's not easy to do. There are side effects. You need to be monitoring things. There are different expert opinions of what to look out for in this process. Now, in regards to the dasatinib, you know, this one's a little bit trickier to prescribe because it is a chemotherapeutic agent used for leukemia. It's a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. It's very expensive. I have sourced it for my patients and made it available through compounding, but that's a different discussion. But essentially, if even on GoodRx and some of these discounted resources, it's about $15,000 a month for dasatinib on average. Now, it's definitely not that way on a compounded level, and you're not using those higher doses that cancer patients need. But that is something that is out there. There's only a handful of docs in the country that I think are really exploring these interventions. You know, I had the privilege to spend time and speak to a lot of these docs with my involvement with the American Academy for Anti-Aging Medicine. So definitely on the forefront of exploring these strategies and these different interventions for anti-aging. So that's dasatinib. Now, the sirolimus is a little bit more commercially available, and there are different strategies around that. So that's very easy to come across. Cost per consumer is a little bit lower. But again, you need to make sure you're working with a skilled provider that knows how to appropriately dose titrate this medication, because common side effects, besides like aphthous ulcers, is the risk for potentially secondary infections from immunosuppression. And this goes back to the terrain theory, that the terrain needs to be clear first and foremost, because when it comes down to these secondary infections, you could really disrupt the balance with immunosuppression and allow for opportunistic growth of dysbiotic microorganisms in the gut, the urogenital system, and all throughout, even believe it or not, in the vasculature. We have biofilms all throughout our body, right? Starting with our mouth and the plaque in our mouth, there's these biofilms in the vasculature. For your audience that may not know what that is, but biofilms are essentially these little colonies. I call them like these like mega resorts for microbial colonization within the body. We have it in our lungs and our digestive tract, our urogenital system, everywhere. We have these biofilms, and it basically houses these different microorganisms. They get together, they share a drink, usually what you're drinking. They have a meal, usually what you're eating, and they protect themselves from the immune system. And you can't see, the immune system does not have the ability to go in and attack them. Let's say we're cleaning the terrain. For some reason, we identified infectious issues, dysbiosis, or whatever. Making sure you're disrupting and breaking down those biofilms and dealing with these opportunistic potentials and secondary infections are going to be very important before entering in a senolytic protocol. So again, immunosuppression, secondary infections, a big potential side effect, you know, for this. And even for those that think otherwise, that healthy with no major issues, just make sure and probe that, you know, a little bit further. Do your due diligence, because these secondary infections are a real potential. And then not to mention, again, it has a potential for blunting some of these meds, being chemotherapeutic immunosuppressive agents, blunting the potential for hematopoiesis, which is basically your body's bone marrow's response to producing red cells, white cells, and platelets into circulation. So monitoring platelet levels and activity, your red blood cell count, your HNH, and your white blood cell count is important. Now, some docs will make the argument that actually when you start seeing that little dip is when you know that you're targeting and ramping up, so to speak. And so some docs actually embrace that dip, but that you just got to be careful with that and monitoring it through routine blood work.
As far as continuous use versus intermittent or the hit and run approach, how do you go about using these agents?
I think it should be used right now. All the literature has been looking at it from a hit and run kind of hypothesis. And again, that just means short durations on and then taking some time off to recoup and clear the medicine out of your system. But that gives your body some time to regenerate from that kind of insult, because it is an insult. You know, you're taking a chemotherapeutic immunosuppressive drug. The hit and run is something that has the most amount of research right now to demonstrate its efficacy. And most of the clinical trials are 3 days on, 4 days off, anywhere from 1 to 3 weeks so far. But there's a few different clinical studies undergoing right now that have a little bit longer duration, lower of dose. Again, the next 6 to 18 months are going to be really exciting as these studies begin to be published. So hit and run is the way that I would recommend it. You know, some people recommend the sirolimus kind of weekly dosing, but I have mixed opinions about that. Again, I think it should be used in context of the individual. Everything is N of one. And N of one means essentially that you are at the center of your own clinical trial. And this, you know, kind of resonates with the biohackers and longevity enthusiasts, because we know that what's good for me is not maybe the best option here for you. And I think we need to take into account all those unique variables that influence our health expression in determining the best course of everything. So there's so many different factors to take into consideration when dealing with this. In my practice, I like to connect those molecular dots, so to speak, from genome to pathophenome. And then at a certain point, once we get into the age management side of things, we need to, again, prepare the terrain through intermittent fasting, maybe fasting mimicking diet and so forth to lead up to, I think, receiving the message of these different medications.
There's so many different senolytics and senomorphics. Do you normally recommend people just take one or two? Would they maybe want to take all of them to target sort of different pathways within the cells? How would we go about choosing how to do that?
I actually have different protocols here for different conditions. So I have a protocol for osteoporosis, something for neurodegeneration, Alzheimer's, cardiovascular issues. So there are different kind of strategies there, you know, and it's not just doing just a senolytic and then done, but it's how to kind of, again, during this time period, 1 to 3 months, what are the additional supplements and other targets that we need to work on as well? So these protocols that I use, different supportive agents as well. It just depends, but there is a therapeutic order. And again, one of the things that we did not touch about was the association with NAD, for example, and the development of these different senescent cells in circulation. So where does NAD come into play with all this? And when do we start repleting NAD, before or after? All these little things should be looked at first before, I think, executing this kind of program.
You mentioned that you need to consider the potential to regenerate tissues as well as removing these senescent cells. So maybe talk a little bit about strategies that people might use for that regeneration, combining senolytics with stem cells or things like this?
That's a great question, because as we get older and we start accumulating all this damage, the wear and tear of life, of love and lust, everything that leads to who we are, you know, and where we're at, geez, there's so many different factors. There are different arguments in this space as well that, you know, maintaining a certain level of senescent cells is important at preventing cancer. That's also out there in the literature. I don't want to sit here and say, oh, you need to remove all these cells. Sometimes we take things and we explore and we go too far, and next thing you know, we're doing harm. So the goal is not to do harm with this, but to try to leverage this to help and improve our aging process. So again, I want to make it clear is that this is still the wild, wild west. There are no set regimens or anything else. It's an emerging field of science and aging medicine. You need to be prepared. If you're going to be removing these agents from circulation, remember how I said that it could have the potential of immunosuppression and then suppress your hematopoiesis, your body's ability to synthesize these cells. I believe every 10 seconds, approximately, we're putting out 1 million white blood cells, 30 million red blood cells, and about 50 million platelets into circulation. Right. So that's taking place every 10 seconds. We're just spewing out those cells. So we need to make sure we have the appropriate regenerative potential after we remove these senescent cells. And I think that comes with nutritional status, right? And having the cofactors needed to undergo the appropriate cell signaling for regeneration, collagen synthesis, for tissue repair. I also think that one of the big factors here deal with the Yamanaka factors. And I don't know if you've heard of this, but this is basically one of the Nobel Prize in early 2000s was given to a Japanese researcher that demonstrated the ability to regenerate stem cells with a very specific targeted factors. And this later became known as the Yamanaka factors for its ability to regenerate stem cell integrity and cause cells to revert back to its kind of natural primordial programming, so to speak. Essentially, there's a lot of things to take into consideration. You know, we have these CHIP cells as well, clonal hematopoietic cells of indeterminate potential. So CHIP cells are a part of it. Yamanaka factors are a part of it. And knowing how to go in there. But to answer your question, yes, if we're dealing with, you know, somebody with really bad ALS, right? And we're going to explore a senolytic kind of protocol here, per se, it's going to be important to have something on the back end to help with the potential for regeneration, myelin sheath formation, nerve regeneration, and so forth. So I think stem cells, exosomes, peptides are all exciting different interventions on the horizon that have some therapeutic potential. And, you know, we have these institutions. University of Florida has a regenerative medicine institute that's booming right now and exploring a lot of this. And several other universities around the country, we're starting to see these regenerative medicine research institutions. That's huge with the academics. So I think it's a very exciting time in medicine that we are exploring these different resources for trying to combat the aging process here.
Amir, did you have any questions that you'd like to add?
Can senolytics also affect healthy tissues?
It depends on the senolytic. But yes, absolutely. I definitely think these drugs, one of the biggest arguments about chemotherapeutic agents is that it has sometimes a non-discretion. It's going to go in there, especially with dasatinib. It's a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. So, you know, all these cells are expressing tyrosine kinase, right? So it's going to shut down this process within healthy tissues as well. And we could have the innocent bystander effect with that. And this is why these agents need to be managed and monitored very closely in these kind of protocols.
It actually leads to the next question. There's a common best practice of combining different senolytics. Is this because each one of them target different types of senescent cells or different areas in the body where they accumulate, or they worked in synergy? What is the reason behind it?
That's a great question. And that boils down to, I think, the mechanism of action of these senolytics. So it's important to keep in mind that a lot of these senolytics have been discovered through a library out of Mayo Clinic. Dr. Kirkland's lab out of Mayo Clinic is leading the way in this research. What he's found is through this library of different agents, he's pulled out some of these top agents. Dasatinib and quercetin just seems to be the one that has the most efficacy, but they're targeting different molecular pathways and endpoints. This would be better graphically represented. But with the senolytics more specifically, it has the ability anywhere to affect on a nuclear level with P53 and MDM2 pathways. It could also affect PPAR alpha pathways, BCL2 pathways, the PI3K pathways. So it depends on the agent that you're targeting and the main mechanism, because there are four main ways to remove senescent cells out of circulation. One is through inducing apoptosis, right? So those are basically going to be targeting pathways more specifically that inhibit the pro-survival pathways, right? And when you map out the different pathways that influence pro-survival, there's FOXO4, P53, HDAC, ATMs, caspases, BCL2, PI3CK, PI3K. All of those things are involved with the cell's ability to evade apoptosis. So senolytics that target apoptosis is very unique. Again, fisetin, the dasatinib, and quercetin. And there's multiple other agents, including statin drugs, you know, are now being considered having some synomorphic potential. Cardiac glycosides like digoxin being considered senolytic because of its inhibition of sodium ATPase enzyme activity in a cell. So it really just depends. And I do agree that targeting different mechanisms will be beneficial. But again, it's still a wild, wild west. I don't want to be overly aggressive. I do believe that there is a healthy balance of senescent cells that are needed to have a benefit. There are some arguments, again, that going in there and removing those senescent cells and trying to modulate the SASP is your body's defense mechanism against developing cancer. So that is something that I just really want to caution the audience and everybody that, well, let's not get too excited yet that this might be the next major intervention. It should be used with responsibility. But I mentioned there's four different ways. We spoke about the apoptotic way of removing these cells. There's another way, the SENS Institute in California, for example. These researchers are using natural killer cells, what's called CAR NK cells, to target very specific proteins to remove senescent cells from circulation. This is adapting it from the CAR T model for cancer therapy, which is chimeric antigen receptor cells. And they're using the NK versus T cells to help remove these cells from circulation through an immune-mediated mechanism. Another less favorable way of going through and actually genetically manipulating senescent cells, that's actually less studied, less favorable because of the risk for cancer. And then the fourth way of removing these senescent cells is a modulation of SASP. This is where we get into the mTOR, the MAP kinases, the JAK-STAT pathways, and nuclear factor kappa beta and so forth. So again, there are different molecular targets for different things depending on the situation. And I think it's important to look at the big picture of what's going on first before jumping into an aggressive protocol.
Fantastic message. While people are on their hit and run, do they normally feel better during it? Do they often feel terrible during it and better after? What would people expect?
Fatigue is oftentimes a very common side effect. Decreased exercise tolerance and endurance, some of the symptoms that I've seen. In most cases, those are some of the biggest kind of noticeable side effects with it. It's not a pleasant process of going in there and taking a chemotherapeutic agent. But what's exciting is, you know, again, the fisetin, I am really hopeful that the fisetin trials in humans shine through here because I personally would rather use natural agents versus these aggressive drug and chemotherapeutic immunosuppressive agents. Fisetin being an alkaloid derived from a natural source. Again, not everything derived from natural source is always safe, but I would feel more comfortable with something of that nature. I usually stack fisetin with some of the senolytic protocols that I have here.
We hear from a lot of people that use fisetin, quercetin, because they also have other benefits. I'm not sure if the dosage is similar to the dosage of hit and run senolytic protocol, but is this something that people should be concerned about? Do you feel natural options are usually safer compared to drugs like dasatinib?
Yeah, you know, for right now, I think the bulk of the studies that are being done on fisetin is looking at 20 mg per kg in body weight for dosing. And then some of the other more commercial kind of protocols are around 12 to 1500 milligrams of fisetin, generally speaking, for dosing versus taking quercetin for COVID prophylaxis due to its zinc ionophoric benefit and activity of around 500 milligrams, whereas some of the upper dosing of the quercetin was anywhere from 1,000 and above of the quercetin. A lot of these flavonoids, again, they have multiple different targets and benefits clinically. You know, like I just mentioned with quercetin and it's being a zinc ionophore, it's also something that's very important in mast cell stabilization and preventing this kind of dysregulated histamine response in some individuals. So there's a lot of different pleiotropic benefits and activities from these different alkaloids that are from these natural sources.
As we're wrapping up here, what would be your general advice for somebody who's concerned about senescent cells? Your top tips for how to optimize the lifestyle and how to think about what to do?
Test, don't guess. Make sure that there is something on board. I do think that if you're looking to get a snapshot of where you're at with some of this, I really like Dr. Shi with Genfinity Labs out of University of Georgia. He's received so much NIH funding for his research in senescent cells and cervical cancer. His lab is really, really well defined. There's mixed opinions on some of those forms of testing and everything else. But right now, in regards to commercial facing testing, I think Genfinity, J-I-N-I-Finity, F-I-N-T-I, is maybe worth looking into to kind of get a better understanding and a baseline of like intracellular NAD concentrations and SAS proteins on top of, I don't know of another place that you can measure SA beta galactosidase, right? And then again, the P16, P21, still not there. Get a ferritin level. You see, you know, where you're at. Test, don't guess. Make sure that you're doing this under the supervision with somebody that knows what they're doing, because there's a lot of potential harm that could come from this, you know, and it's still the wild, wild west. And I love biohacking. I'm all about biohacking. Just make sure that you know what you're doing and not pretend that you know what you're doing. Consult with somebody that knows what they're doing, right?
Seeking that expert advice.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here and for sharing all of this. Lots to think about for a lot of people, whether they were aware of Senolytics before or not. Lots and lots of new information to think about. So thank you so much for sharing all of this amazing wisdom.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Thank you.